Please help me welcome our speaker tonight, Chris from Westfield Big Book Group in New Jersey.
Good evening, everybody. My name is Chris, and I am an alcoholic. It's good to be here tonight. This is not my first time here. This is my first time here speaking outside. I've done a couple of commitments inside before, but oh boy, where have I seen that before? I've been here a couple of times inside, and I know that this is a really, really great group, a very, very enthusiastic group, and I certainly appreciate being asked to come out here. You know, a couple of things in the preamble struck me. I love the set-aside prayer. You know, I've always, you know, I don't say this much, but I think serenity is overrated. You know what I mean? And when meetings start with the serenity prayer, when you look in the big book Alcoholics Anonymous, all of the prayers are really selfless. They're all about, you know, helping us to become, you know, better message carriers. Help us to be prepared to be able to help the next person. And then most meetings in my area start with the serenity prayer, which is, you know, make me serene so everything can be mellow. It just doesn't seem to go well with the rest of the recovery literature. So I like the set-aside prayer, because what I bring to Alcoholics Anonymous, what I brought to Alcoholics Anonymous in the early days was a host of defective belief systems, a host of prejudices. I knew so much about so many things that was wrong. You know, I mean, I've changed my mind, believe it or not, you know, over the years being in Alcoholics Anonymous. I've changed my mind practically about everything. You know, alert the press. Chris is changing his mind. Because I don't know about anybody else, but it was very, very difficult for me to do that. I think the alcoholic is a very, very stubborn individual. You know, we know, and, you know, no new information for me, thanks. So the set-aside prayer is a great place to start. Usually when I'm working with people or taking them through the steps, I ask them to do the set-aside prayer, you know, every single time that they start to look at the steps. Because we really do need an open mind. You know, if we bring to the problem an answer, you know, because we know we're never going to find the real solution. Because if we already have the solution, or we already believe the solution is not going to work, you know, we're going to shoot ourselves in the foot every single time. Now, I said earlier I am an alcoholic. I do know what that means today. For the longest time in Alcoholics Anonymous, I thought an alcoholic was somebody that drank a lot. You know, that's certainly a symptom of alcoholism. But I really had it wrong. I thought I was an alcoholic because I drank too much. I understand today I drank too much because I'm an alcoholic. And that's a very, very different thing. I believe that in the science that they're coming up with today, in some of the serious alcoholism studies, I believe that this is a genetic bullet. I believe we are genetically predestined to become alcoholics. All we need to do is add alcohol, and that's exactly what I started to do. I started to add alcohol when I was about 13 years old, and it became an obsession for me. You know, the first time I ever drank alcohol, two of my buddies and myself decided we were going to cut school and we were going to go back to my mother's house and we were going to get drunk. So we cut school, we went to my mother's house, and I pulled down a bottle of Four Roses whiskey. That was just what was in the front. Poured out a bunch of water glasses filled with this whiskey for myself and my two buddies, and we started to drink. And right from the get-go, I had a different relationship with alcohol than these two other guys. Because here's what happened. They had about two-thirds of the glass of whiskey, and they'd had enough. They stopped there. You ever drink with people like that? You know, they stop in the middle of a drink or something. And, you know, it's really annoying. And that's what they did. They had about 2/3 of their glass, and they'd had enough. And they sat back and they watched the show, because what happened with me was, I finished my glass, I finished their glasses, I finished the bottle, and I came to later that afternoon, after being in a blackout, I came to out in the field somewhere. I mean, it was, it was my first instance of having a blackout. And, I also, for about 2 days, I was incredibly sick. You remember your first real drunk, just how sick you were? Oh, my God, I was sick. I couldn't, I had to be horizontal for like 2 days. Now, being that sick and having a blackout, losing time and not remembering what I had done and worried about if I did anything stupid, it was very traumatic for me. But I didn't stop drinking because of this experience. Quite the contrary, I recognized alcohol as something I needed to start to work with. I needed to work with this alcohol because it did something for me that was absolutely remarkable. Up to this point in time, being a 12 or a 13-year-old, I had what you would today call like social anxiety. I had that self-centered fear, being uncomfortable with myself, with my environment, not being in the right place at the right time with the right people. Things were just always uncomfortable for me. I didn't like school, and I didn't like crowds, and a lot of things embarrassed me, and I worried about a lot of stuff, especially about what you thought of me. And I was I had this real repressed anxiety all the time. Now, when I started drinking that Four Roses whiskey, about into the second drink, that left me. This was the anti-Chris potion that was remarkable. All that fear and anxiety and worrying about everything just dropped from me. And I felt like I thought all of you felt all the time. I thought, this just fixed me. Everything is wonderful. I feel larger than life. And it was an amazing experience until I went into a blackout and who knows what happened. But what I remembered was what alcohol did for me. And with the alcoholic, alcohol does for us what we cannot do for ourselves. We have a remarkable relationship with alcohol. Alcohol is really a solution for us. And it's a solution because of the spiritual malady that we have. Being that kid that was always uncomfortable with everything, that's part of the alcoholic spiritual malady. And I had that from like age 4 on. So that's why I believe I drank a lot, because I'm an alcoholic. I believe I was an alcoholic from like age 4 on, because I fit all the symptoms that they talk about in the book Alcoholics Anonymous. Restless, irritable, discontented. Prey to misery, depression, self-centered fear, guilt, remorse, pitiful and incomprehensible demoralization. I was to get to know that a little bit in the later years. But when I discovered alcohol, I discovered a tool that I could use to be able to feel okay. And so, I'm moving into high school, and in high school, there's a lot of parties, and there's dances, and there's all this stuff. And I started to use the alcohol to be able to do okay at those things. And I did this quite often. And this was the early 70s, so, there was some non-conference approved substances that were around, and I partook of those, let me tell you. In a very alcoholic way, I used those. But I just found that I needed to be out of me. Sobriety was untenable for me. So I don't believe alcohol is my main problem. When you go to work on something, when you go to solve a problem, if you're working on the wrong problem, sometimes you're working on the wrong solution. And when I first showed up in Alcoholics Anonymous, they were... they were telling me, or I was hearing, because sometimes it's the receiver and not the transmitter that's off. But what I was hearing was, Chris, all you need to do is not take a drink one day at a time and just keep coming back and everything is going to be fine. Well, my experience in early Alcoholics Anonymous was everything was not fine. I'm gonna tell a story here that kind of describes, that'll show you what I'm talking about alcohol being the solution. The last 3 or 4 years of my drinking, I was working as a bad electrician for a bad contractor, and I was drinking every single night. I mean, I was drinking hard liquor every single night until I passed out. And what would happen is this. I would get off of work about 4:30, and I would beeline it to the liquor store. And there was a specific liquor store that I would go to, and that liquor store had my vodka or it had my bourbon. Those were my two drinks. And I made sure that liquor store would never run out of this stuff. You know, I had a relationship with the guy. You know, do not run out of this. And what I would do is I would fly to the liquor store. I would run in. I'd always have my $20 or whatever I needed. And I'd grab the bottle, and I'd go up, and I'd pay for it, and I'd get myself home. I needed to be, if I got off of work at 4:30, I needed to be home cracking the top of that bottle at 4:45. You know, this was my routine. And I remember this one time, you know, I go into the liquor store, I grab my vodka, and I'm heading up to pay for it. And there's a woman who's talking to the guy at the cash register. And she's going, do you know what kind of wine goes with tilapia? You know, and I'm like, you know, what? You know, pay for that, move on. And then the guy starts going, well, you know, there's a Cabernet from the California region that has a nice blush, you know, and it goes well with white fish. And I'm like, are you crazy? She wants to know what kind of, just give her a bottle of Gallo and get her the hell out of the way. Okay, I need to buy this vodka. I need to get the hell out of here. You know, get her out of here. I'm like freaking out. I'm like, I got a problem here. I'm sober. You know, get me out of here. Now, does it sound like I have an alcohol problem when I tell a story like that? I had a sobriety problem. I couldn't stand it. So the problem, though, with alcohol is it turns on you over any considerable period of time. You know, alcoholism gets worse. It never gets better. You end up drinking more. You need more alcohol, and then it causes more problems. So it's a solution that turns on you. You know, you become addicted to it, and it's a really, really bad solution. So I knew, this is like early 1989, I knew that alcohol was going to kill me. And I knew I had a real problem. I'd been in outpatient to get my license back for multiple DUIs. You know, I had a hard time when I was driving. You know, I always felt like, you know, hit the road with confidence. You know, have a stiff drink with you when you're you know, behind the wheel, for God's sake. And that didn't work real well for me, you know, because I was crashing a lot of cars and getting a lot of DUIs, you know. But I'm the type of person who, you know, I had my third DUI, and I woke up the next morning going, I gotta stop driving. You know, it wasn't like, it's not like I gotta stop drinking. You know, that didn't even cross my mind at that period of time. But alcohol did get my attention in early 1989 because I was drinking so much, I was literally poisoning myself. You know, we talk a lot about hangovers, whether we had them or whether we didn't. Well, if you drink hard liquor alcoholically, it's not a hangover. It's alcohol poisoning. You're putting enough ethyl alcohol into your body to cause unbelievable amounts of damage to your liver, your organs, your head, your thinking. You know, we have all kinds of problems as alcoholics with how destructive this alcohol is. But if you're drinking like a quart of whiskey a night, you're literally poisoning yourself with the alcohol. And I would wake up in the morning just poisoned. And 2 or 3 years before I signed myself into treatment, this is basically what the day would look like. I would come to in the morning, you know, wearing the clothes that I had passed out in the night before, you know, the alarm would be going off. I'd have to be at work in 20 minutes or something. So I'd stagger into the bathroom and, you know, I'd throw some water on my face. I'd do my vomiting calisthenics. You know, I'd brush my teeth, you know, and I'd head out to the car, you know. I'd get in my $100 car and make it to my bad job, you know, like just shattered, barely able to think. It was, you know, I used to blow stuff up on a daily basis as an electrician. If I wasn't electrocuting me, I was electrocuting other people, you know. It was bad. I went through helpers pretty quick. But sometimes I'd electrocute them on purpose if I didn't like them. You know, I go, work on this box over here. Yeah. You know, they change their career after two or three times like that. But anyway, you know, I'd head off to my job and I would be swearing to God I'm never going to drink again. Today is the day. I know I've said this before. But today is the day I'm going to give up alcohol because I can't stand feeling this way. I mean, literally, I was poisoned. And you know, I'll tell you what, if there was a polygraph expert and he hooked up the lie detector to me at 8 o'clock in the morning when I'm starting work, and he'd say, Chris, are you ever going to drink again? No. That needle would go right to true. I'm never going to drink again because I so meant it. You know, that was a sane decision. I'm not going to poison myself anymore. That's a smart, sane thing to say. So, I absolutely meant it. But what would happen is, around lunchtime, you know, I'd rehydrate. I'd drink like a half a gallon of liquid, and I'd get maybe half a sandwich down. And I would start to think to myself about that decision I made earlier in the morning, you know, to never, ever drink again. You know, that might be an overreaction, really, to this whole problem. And that decision might have to be, you know, I might have to change that decision, alter that decision a little bit. And, you know, I might even do that on the way home. On the way home today, I think I'll stop at the liquor store and get myself some booze, you know, to make me feel a little bit better. So I would go from in the morning never drinking again to in the middle of the afternoon, I can't wait to get the hell out of here so I can go to the liquor store. Now, that was my pattern for years, and that is so alcoholic. What they talk about in the book Alcoholics Anonymous is they talk about two big symptoms and unmanageability. The two big symptoms of alcoholism are, if you honestly want to, you find you cannot give up alcohol entirely, which was me. I would swear off alcohol every morning and be drunk that night. Or if when drinking you have little control over the amount you take, and that was certainly me, I always drank myself into unconsciousness in the last 3 or 4 years of my drinking because of the physical craving. The big book says you're probably alcoholic. And if those two things weren't bad enough, you know, the obsession of the mind ensures that you continue to drink, and the allergy of the body ensures that you poison yourself with it when you do drink. You know, that's bad enough. But really, the worst part of alcoholism is the unmanageability. The unmanageability, the defective relationships, the misery, the depression, the pitiful and incomprehensible demoralization, you know, the hideous four horsemen, terror, frustration, bewilderment, and despair. Letting down everybody that you care about. Not even understanding why you do the things that you do. Has anybody ever asked you, what's the matter with you? What's wrong with you? Has anybody ever said that to you? What's wrong with you? I mean, you don't even know how to answer that. Like you just burned your house down and got a DWI and you got a bottle of whiskey in your hand. Are you crazy? You know, and you're like, I don't know. You know, I can't answer these questions. You know, leave me alone. You know, get off my back. You know, I'm only hurting myself. I mean, you know, we've got like these defenses that we try. But it's total insanity. It's total insanity. That's what alcoholism is. And that unmanageability is so debilitating. They call it a spiritual malady. They call it unmanageability. It's untreated alcoholism is what it is. It's standing behind the tilapia lady trying to get your bottle of vodka. That's the unmanageability. I got to get out of here, you know. It's just absolute insanity. Now, I show up in Alcoholics Anonymous. I had gone through a 28-day treatment program. I was in outpatient. I was going to AA meetings when I relapsed. Now, this scared me to death. I knew I couldn't just stop drinking. I tried it for years. So I signed myself into a treatment center because that's what you do, right? You know, I saw it on TV. I read it in articles. You sign yourself. So I signed myself into a 28-day treatment program. I'm going to outpatient. I'm going to AA. And I'm never going to drink again. Never, ever, ever. And I'm on my way to an AA meeting, and the thought crosses my mind that, you know, I'm not really doing this AA stuff as good as I probably could. And it's been a long time since I've been drunk. Like, it's almost 3 months now, and I'll bet if I bought a gallon of vodka and drank it, it would remind me what it's like to be drunk, and I would go back to AA and really do a good job because it would make me feel so bad. So I bought a gallon of vodka and drank it to improve my sobriety. Now that's powerless, okay? You want to talk about what powerless looks like? It looks like I was the person in the AA meeting who wanted to stay separated from alcohol more than anybody else in those chairs. I guarantee you I wanted to stay away from alcohol more than anybody in those AA meetings. But I somehow convinced myself that it would help me to put alcohol back in my body. And this is what happened. I'm pouring out glasses of vodka and orange juice, and I'm drinking them. This is a good idea. This makes a lot of sense. This makes a lot of sense. I get to, like, my third drink, and all of a sudden I realize the enormity of my error. Oh, my God, I'm drunk. I've opened up the cage door to the beast. And the beast is just going to drag me around for who knows how long. What have I done? And in the book, Alcoholics Anonymous, Bill talks about, you know, slamming your fist on the bar, asking yourself, how could you have been so foolish to do this one more time? Well, that's the obsession of the mind. That's the powerlessness. If we could stop drinking ourselves, we wouldn't be powerless. If there's anything you can do to prevent alcohol from going into your body yourself, you would not be powerless. Just do that and you'll be fine. Now, there's nothing I could come up with. You know, AA wasn't even powerful enough. The meetings, the treatment centers, the aftercare, none of that was powerful enough to keep me convinced I needed to stay away from alcohol. That's how powerful the obsession of the mind is sometimes. Now, I was out for about 7 months. It was just gruesome. It was the most decadent, pathetic existence of my entire life. And I came out of the smoke, you know, and ashes of that in between Christmas and New Year's 1989. And I staggered my way, literally. I hadn't slept in about 4 days. I'd gone through the DTs on the floor of my house, just fish flopping and hallucinating and seeing animals. It was just awful. And without any sleep, I went out to my $100 car and I drove to an AA meeting. And I was just shattered. And, I was not at all convinced Alcoholics Anonymous was going to work. I tried it. I was out of plans. I didn't know what else to do. Maybe if I go back and I try it harder, I thought. And so that's what I did. I went back to AA. I got a sponsor on my second night. I literally went to a meeting every night for my first 8 years. I didn't have anything else better to do. I'd blown my life up so bad there was nothing else on the agenda that was gonna be better than that. But I started to go to meetings. At that time, we're talking about very, very early 1990 in New Jersey. At that period of time, the Alcoholics Anonymous was basically discussion meetings, step meetings, and some speaker meetings. And in those meetings, there were a lot of really, really good people who were staying sober. A lot of people were staying sober. It was a very different way to do AA than I'm involved with today. I love the preamble in this particular meeting. This particular meeting, suggests very, very strongly that you go through the steps with a sponsor. That is not what was going on in 1990 in the North Jersey area where I was. Basically, what was going on was there was a lot of encouragement to stay close to the fellowship and to do service work. There wasn't the type of thing that you see nowadays where a sponsor or a spiritual advisor's responsibility many times is to help someone go through the steps. That's normal now, and that's very, very accepted. When I first started doing that, it was bizarre, and people thought I was wacky to be bringing people over to my house and going through the steps just because it wasn't being done back then. There was a lot of encouragement to stay sober. There was a lot of encouragement to stay close. There was encouragement to do service work. And all that is really good unless you're in real trouble with alcoholism. If you're in real trouble with alcoholism, all that work may not be enough to keep you safe and protected, to keep you separated from alcohol. I'm just hanging on. I am just hanging on in AA in the early months. And I got to tell you, I had such a desire to not drink. But I was insane. I remember, I would go into a meeting and, a lot of times we look better than we are, especially if we're newcomers. We know how to appear normal. Because we need to learn that skill to get along at all in life. But what's going on up here is a lot of times not normal. I remember sitting in this one meeting one time, and I'd just sit there like this with a smile on my face. I'd do the serenity prayer, and, then the meeting would start. And most of the meetings I was going to were sharing meetings. They were discussion meetings because that's what most everybody was doing. They were going to these discussion meetings. And, somebody be sharing that I didn't like. And I go, oh, my God, listen to this guy. Listen to this hypocrite. Oh, man. And then, I look over and say, oh, no, he's raising his hand. Oh, please, God, no, he's raising his hand. Don't call on him, will you please? Don't. Oh, they're calling on him. Oh, my God. Now I got to hear him talk about his family. Oh, geez, will you just tell somebody who cares, please? Oh, now he's grateful. Oh, now he's grateful. Sure. Okay, you know what I'm going to do? I'm going to go out and I'm going to slash all four of his tires. I'm going to follow him out of the meeting because I want to see gratitude in action. And this is what's going through my head, And thanks for sharing. How you doing, Chris? Great. Wonderful. Everything's great. I'm grateful. I'm insane. Now, luckily, thank God, this guy, Radio Shack Mike, he was one of my first buddies in AA. He was just insane enough to hang out with me. He used to go to the New Age bookstores. He was like into all this, whatever he could get into, he was into. One day it'd be affirmations and he'd be giving me Louise Hay tapes. Next day it would be like the Course in Miracles. This is the Course in Miracles. This is great. Road Less Travel. You got to read this. I mean, he was back and forth with all these. He was like a spiritual pinball, just back and forth with all this stuff. And one day he comes to me and he hands me 8 90-minute cassette tapes, big stack like this. He goes, yeah, I didn't really care much for this, but you're hardcore. You'll probably like these. And he hands me these things. And what they are is they're a Big Book workshop by a couple of guys named Joe and Charlie. This is sometime in late 1990. And I'm like, 8 90-minute tapes on the Big Book? People do that? That cannot be good. Especially if they're from Arkansas, because they're going to talk really slow. And I'm going to want to speed the tape up. So I'm from New Jersey, But anyway, I promised them I'd listen to these things. And I put them, I had a long ride to work. So I was listening to them on the way to work. And, I got to tell you, they didn't really go over really well in my first listen. I got a big resentment, as a matter of fact. I got a big resentment because basically the message that these tapes were giving to me, the message I was hearing was, you know, Chris, you're a fellowship behemoth. You're like the Pope of the fellowship, but you have no AA program because you're not working the steps out of the book Alcoholics Anonymous, and that is what an AA program is. If you think you're working your program, that's probably what you're doing. You're working your program, but your program is not an AA program. And if you're really alcoholic and you're not working an AA program and you're not going to have a spiritual awakening as a result of the steps because you're not going to work the steps, you're probably going to drink. And when you do drink, please don't tell people that AA didn't work because you weren't even coming close to working AA. Now, this is what I hear right now. I'm pissed about this because I'm going to like 12 meetings a week. People are patting me on the head, telling me I'm doing great. Oh, Chris, you're doing great. You know, see you at all the meetings. You know, you're even starting to share. But what these tapes were basically saying was that not only I didn't have a clue, but none of the people at any of the meetings I was going to had a clue. Now, that didn't go over well because my sponsor, my home group, I love these people. You know what I mean? And, you know, my first initial run through these tapes was I was going, maybe that's how they do it down in Little Rock, you know, Arkansas. But in New Jersey, we share. You know, that's how we stay sober. We share. And I was pissed about these tapes. I gave them a bad review to Radio Shack Mike. However, you know, there's a great line in the chapter Working with Others. It says, if you've disturbed your prospect about their alcoholism, this is all to the good. You know, if you've disturbed them. And I understand what that means now because I had to internalize this information that I got from Joe and Charlie. The truth will haunt you if you're alcoholic. You're gonna want to deny it all, but the truth will haunt you. And what happened to me was a whole bunch of bad stuff happened to me really quickly. A state caught up to me because I fled to avoid prosecution. Go figure. I lost a job. I lost a girlfriend. And all at once, and I was like devastated. I had no spiritual armor to be able to handle the trials and low spots ahead that it talks about in the big book. And what happened was I was just devastated. And we get to a point, if you're alcoholic and you don't have a spiritual awakening, if you don't build up a spiritual defense, if you're alcoholic, one of three things is going to happen to you. I don't care how many meetings you go to. One of three things is going to happen to you. You're going to go insane, you're going to take your own life, or you're going to drink. If you don't have that shift in personality sufficient to recover from alcoholism, one of those three things, it may take 20 or 30 years for that to happen. It may take 2 or 3 days. But one of those three things are going to happen because I was getting really close to, you know, the edge. And I remembered these tapes. I said, you know what? I'm going to try this. And it was not out of any sense of virtue. I just didn't want to feel bad anymore. So I took these tapes down off the shelf. I blew the dust off of my big book. I had a big book from when I was in treatment. Hadn't looked at it since. It's been over a year. I blew the dust off of it. And I opened it up. And anybody been in treatment and, you know, people signed your big book in treatment? You know, Chris, you're the craziest bastard I've ever met. You're never going to make it. Love, Harry. You know, those are the things that are written in my big book. I'm like, oh, my God. But I start listening to the tapes. I open up the book. I have a notebook. And I start going through the Joe and Charlie tapes. And I start going through the big book. And where there's an instruction to actually do something, I stop and I actually try to do that instruction before I move forward. And I start to take myself through the steps. I remember when I went to my sponsor with my resentment, my fear, and my conduct inventory. And he said, where's your story? You know, what's all these inventories? I mean, that's what was going on in my area at the time. No one had any experience with an AA inventory. So I said, don't worry about the story. Please listen to this. I've got some stuff I've got to run by you. And I read the inventories. Now, what happened was, because I was attempting to go through the steps, what was going on was my spirit was healing. It talks about in the spiritual appendix in the back of the big book, it talks about, you know, some of us have had spiritual awakenings of the educational variety. They happen slowly over the course of time. Some people have sudden and profound spiritual experiences, but other people have spiritual awakenings slowly over the course of time. And that's really what was happening with me, because I was going through the steps slowly over the course of time. But what was happening was my spirit was healing. And I didn't even recognize it, but I started to get better. People were recognizing it a lot quicker than I was. You know, people were saying, Chris, you know, what the hell's going on with you? You look calm. You know, that's unusual for you. Things like that. Now, I started to sponsor a different way. I had some sponsees, and I was doing basically what I had been taught by my sponsor and some other people, which is, here's my phone number, you know, give me a call. If we need to get together or just go to meetings or whatever, I'm available. That's how I was sponsoring. Basically, okay, I'll be your sponsor. What do you want me to do? Just bizarre. But I started to sponsor according to what I had learned from the Joe and Charlie tapes in the Big Book. There's a wonderful chapter called Working with Others that I started to use a little bit as far as a guide to work with others, believe it or not, you know. Actually using the chapter Working with Others as a guide to work with others. I know that's unusual. But I started to do that, and I started to bring people over to my house, and we started at the title page, and we went through the book Alcoholics Anonymous, and I learned some very, very interesting things while I was doing this. And the lesson cannot be, for me, more profound. And here's basically what it is. I started doing this in like 1991. I started bringing people over to my house to take them through the steps. The people that went through the steps with me, who actually did a fourth step and a fifth step, who actually did a nine-step list or eight-step list and actually went out and made amends, who developed a prayer and meditation discipline and who started to work with other people and take other people through the steps, every single one of those guys are still around. And we're talking decades later. Every single one of those guys are still around. They're AA members in good standing, working with other people. The people who balked maybe at the fourth step or the fifth step, or thought that the ninth step was kind of an overreaction to this whole thing, and, you know, Chris wants me to go make amends, you know, this other guy just wants me to be the cookie guy. You know, I'm going with the cookie guy. You know, the people who didn't make it through with me, every single one are gone. I'm not saying they're drinking. They're just not in my orbit anymore. You know, they're not in AA, as far as I know, at least in my area. So every single person that didn't go through the steps is gone. Every single person that went through the steps with me is still here. I mean, that lesson couldn't be more profound for me. You know, so I understand through my own experience the power of these steps. So when this meeting opened up and mentioned that, you know, it's recommended that you go through the steps with a sponsor, you know, if you want to stay separated from alcohol, if you want to recover from alcoholism, it's an awful good idea to do that. If you see it as an overreaction, maybe it's not, because maybe it is an overreaction for you. Not everybody that shows up in AA is an alcoholic these days. You know, there are a lot of heavy drinkers. There's a lot of people who, you know, come in here because of interventions or get referred in here from professionals or whatever, and that's fine. I have absolutely no issue with that. But for the people who are powerless over alcohol and who are really in trouble with alcohol, it's a good idea not to pay attention to what other people are doing. It's a good idea to pay attention to what the book Alcoholics Anonymous asks you to do. I know that for a fact. You know, nobody in AA wants to hurt you, you know, by giving you bad advice or not pointing you in the right direction. It's not that. A lot of times we only know what we know. How do you know what you don't know? So if you've been able to stay sober without the steps for a long period of time, you may think other people can do that too. And you're probably going to be wrong, because there's a scale in alcoholism. It says in the ninth step promises, no matter how far down the scale you've gone, you'll find your experience can benefit others. And then there's another line, and I think it's more about alcoholism, where it says, your ability to quit drinking on a non-spiritual basis will depend on how much control you've lost in drink. So some of us are sicker than others. That's just the way it is. Some of us have really bad alcoholism. Some of us have just touched the nip of the ringer, like Bill talks about. But if you really are sick with alcohol, you need to be engaging in the solution. I'm involved with some professional entities. I'm on some boards of directors. And every once in a while, I'm on some of these LinkedIn groups. There's LinkedIn group for addiction professionals. And I'll get on there just to stir up trouble every once in a while. And this one guy really pissed me off. You got to understand, I love Alcoholics Anonymous. There may be people in here who love Alcoholics Anonymous as much as me, but I can guarantee you there's nobody in here who loves it more than me. This guy is an addiction psychiatrist, okay? He's one of the guys that you pay $250 an hour to go talk about your alcoholism with, and he's got every degree in the world plastered on his wall. This guy is really well respected. He's written books on addiction. Now he starts going after Alcoholics Anonymous, you know, criticizing. So I threw a couple back his way, and he goes, let me tell you something. I don't refer any of my clients to 12-step groups, including Alcoholics Anonymous, anymore, because the success rate in AA is about 6%, and I could get better results by prescribing placebos. Now, this is what this guy says, okay? Now I'm really pissed, because I love Alcoholics Anonymous, and I go to meetings all the time with people who are sober. But I had to start to think about what he was saying. What he's saying is, to a degree, true. His belief system, he's getting those statistics from AA and other people, 6%. This is how they do the statistics. They go to meetings in urban areas, large metropolitan areas, and they've got their clipboard, and when people file in and out of the meeting, they take attendance or whatever. That's how they get their statistics on how many people stay sober in AA. Now, what they're doing is they're taking attendance of people going into meetings, and that's how they're getting their statistics for AA. So I shoot back to this guy. I go, basically, okay, you're a medical doctor. How about if you come up with a cure for a certain kind of cancer and you absolutely know it's going to work? So you set up a hospital and 100 people with that form of cancer come there for treatment. And 90 of them sit in the waiting room and talk about their cancer and share about their cancer and get a cancer sponsor and talk about how grateful they are to have cancer, but those 90 people do not go in to get the operation. I go, would you consider that you had only 10% success rate for the 10 people that go in? Would you say that your cure has a 10% success rate? And he goes, absolutely not. I would only count the 10 people who went in for the operation. And I go, well, you should just be counting the amount of people who go through the steps if you're looking at Alcoholics Anonymous. A lot of people blow through the meetings. You know, everybody in here has probably seen a lot of people blow in and out of these groups. That happens all the time. It's not fair for people to judge Alcoholics Anonymous on people that sit in the waiting room. It's just not. What works for treating alcoholism is the 12 steps. Meetings were never meant to treat alcoholism. They were meant for us to join together and to work together toward the solution. And today, Alcoholics Anonymous is a great place to find people to work with. You know, we're told in the chapter Working with Others that nothing will so much ensure immunity from alcohol than intensive work with other alcoholics. That's the first sentence in the chapter Working with Others. I believe that to be true. So if you want to stay away from alcohol, if you want immunity from alcohol, all you need to do is intensively work with other alcoholics. And a great place to find people to work with is in Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, back in the day, they did not have a lot of meetings. When the book Alcoholics Anonymous was written, there was two groups of drunks. They didn't even call themselves Alcoholics Anonymous yet. They named themselves after the book. But there was an Akron group and a Cleveland group. And when the book was put together, they were very much about working with other people. And they put that chapter together, understanding how important it is to work with other drunks. Today, we're lucky in a way. You can't shake a stick without hitting an AA meeting. If you need to get together with other alcoholics, it is unbelievably easy. You know, back in the 30s and 40s, it was not that easy. Here's what an AA group would look like in the mid-40s. On Monday night, everybody'd get together. It would be the one meeting a week where all the alcoholics, all the recovered alcoholics would get together. Tuesday, they would break off, and some of them would go to the insane asylum. Some of them would go to courts. Some of them would go to the hospitals to try to find prospects for Alcoholics Anonymous. Same thing Wednesday, same thing Thursday. By Friday, most of the people have found prospects, people that they could take through the steps, and they're trying to get them into the hospitals that they have a relationship with. In the early days, whether you needed to be in the hospital or not, they wanted to put you there for two reasons. One of them was to show you how much trouble you're in, because inherent in the illness alcoholism is an utter inability for us to truly assess how much trouble we're in. We're always minimizing. So get them in a hospital bed and then start sending in the boys. You know, one person after another tell their story. And that's basically how the AA group worked. You know, it wasn't always going to meetings. It was much more trying to find other alcoholics and working with other alcoholics. I had an ex-wife. One of my ex-wives called me up one time, and she was from a very alcoholic family. That's why she recognized me as somebody that was attractive to her. She called me up and she said, "My brother's dying. He's in the hospital. He's been drinking himself to death for years. If you can do anything, could you please do something?" And he was in the hospital, okay? He was in there for congestive heart failure and some other problems, and he was going to be in there for about a week. So I thought, you know what? I'm going to do this old school. I'm going to do it the way Dr. Bob did it, okay? Just for the hell of it. Let's check this out. And I called up about 12 of my guys, and I said, okay, Harry, you're at 2 o'clock. Bill, you're at 4 o'clock. Jim, you're at 6 o'clock. And I set up the calendar, the whole weekend calendar, for every 2 hours, these guys are going to go in here. And this is the instruction I gave them. I go, you're going to go in there and you're just going to tell your story. If they want to talk a little, if he wants to talk a little bit, fine. But just go in there and tell him about your alcoholism and what you did to recover. And spend about an hour. And that's what happened. These guys, by like the eighth guy, this guy calls me up and goes, okay, stop sending them. Will you please stop sending them? I'm in. All right, I'm in. And as soon as he was out of the hospital, he was a coffee maker at our group, going through the steps with a sponsor. You know, the congestive heart failure did end up getting him, but I saw how powerful these old tools are. You know, so often we look at the book Alcoholics Anonymous and say, you know, that's the way they did it in the 30s. I'm telling you, the way they did it in the 30s is better than what we're doing today. You know, so often we have a hands-off approach. You know, it's attraction, not promotion. Well, I got to tell you, back in the day, it was all about 12-step promotion. Their public relations policy was attraction, not promotion. But 12-step work was promotion. There's a couple of really wonderful promises in the later chapters of the book Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, one of them is frequent contact with newcomers. It will be the highlight of your life. You know, when I was, you know, 6 months sober, that was not true. But, you know, today it really is. I love working with my guys, especially the newer ones. There's another promise that says, you know, God is going to offer you so much more than you could have dreamed yourself. And that's really true. My life today is just absolutely startlingly unbelievable. I could have never predicted or planned something as good as the life that I'm living today. You know, there's just a number of really, really wonderful promises. Another promise that I love so much is the most satisfactory years of your life are ahead of you. You know, I used to think back, I was one of those guys that while I was drinking, I was thinking about the high school parties. You know, I'm like 33, you know. I mean, I was always looking backwards. And today, you know, the most satisfactory years of my life are ahead of me. That's an unbelievable, unbelievable promise. You know, I'm incredibly grateful. I'm incredibly grateful that I got exposed to the real solution, the solution, Alcoholics Anonymous' solution, which is having had a spiritual awakening as the result of these steps. And one of the greatest things that I do in my life, one of the most satisfactory things I do in my life, is carry this message to the still sick and suffering alcoholic. And every single day I get to work on practicing these principles in all my affairs. And one of these days, I might even get good at it. You know, that's all I have. Thanks for being here tonight.